Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get five Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Don't miss the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. You'll find the Maytag appliances you need, when you need them, at a great price. Plus, when you buy two select laundry appliances, you'll get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop Maytag at Lowe's. We help, you save. Offer valid through 5/31. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. BetterHelp recently surveyed over 16,000 people and found that while 75% of people believe it's wise to seek support, only 27% of Americans are in therapy, and people stay silent to avoid being judged. BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching you with the right therapist, because we're all better with help. Visit BetterHelp.com/stopthestigma for their first ever State of Stigma report. The latest in mental health research.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's been wild in the trial of Karen Reed. A full emotional outburst, forensic firefights, and even some red solo cup crime scene shenanigans. As we gear up to chat with forensic psychologist Siobhan Scott about what all this drama means in human terms, let's recap the latest from Karen's own explicitive-laced voicemails and a panicky "I hit him at the scene, allegedly," to the defense's elaborate house party gone wrong theory getting poked full of holes. There's plenty to unpack. Siobhan, based on everything we've seen, what do Karen's shifting words and behaviors tell you about her state of mind that evening?
You know, I always go back to a very intoxicated woman. There's no doubt about that. And a lot of emotional garbage cooking with her. Not a happy, stable relationship by any means. And just hysteria, you know, a lot of drunken hysteria, which is a bad combination always.
What's interesting about this is just the little snapshot that we got to see of her life. We got to see this chaotic moment. Do you think it happened in a vacuum? Do you think this is just a complete one-off and she's just this hysteric and acting like this? You know, this is a big one-off, or, I mean, this is just speculation, but is this likely kind of a pattern of behavior with her in certain ways, shapes, or forms?
Yeah, people by her age have established patterns of how they do relationships. What they call love, you know, tends to be, certainly sounds like with her, what we know about that night and her phone calls, her 53 phone calls, that there's a pattern of mixing anger with love and a lot of concern about her partner's sexual behavior. And I would guess that this is the way she does relationships, probably not just this moment in time.
You think there's some ex-boyfriends out there that are watching this going, oh, I dodged a bullet here.
I would bet money on that. I would bet money on that. Yes.
If only we could find those people and talk to them. I mean, and if you do want to talk and you are an ex of Karen Reed, there's plenty of ways to get in contact with us. Or honestly, just a friend, acquaintance, somebody who knew her at some level. Before all of this, I don't want to talk about the case. I want to talk about what was it like working with her? What was it like having her as a friend? What was it like having her as a partner, a significant other? If anybody out there wants to talk, we can even do it anonymously. You don't even have to be on the air. I just want to have the conversation. I want a little insight into that, because I think that would tell us a lot. I have a good feeling on what it's going to be, but again, it's all just kind of conjecture. There's a lot to get through here. There's a lot of testimony that has come out since we last talked, and we're going to work through a lot of that. But let's start with the voicemails, because that's been a big thing that we've heard them before, but they were laid out very concisely in court the other day. These are the voicemails from the night of the incident. These are voicemails that started pretty much directly after John O'Keefe was struck, like within minutes, the phone calls start going. So let's just kind of paint the picture here for a moment. And let's assume for a moment that she knows she hit him. Okay. I want to go down that road rather than the road of she's clueless, because I don't think she is. And we'll get more into that in a little bit. But just for the sake of the argument, let's assume she knows something happened, that he's injured. Now, how much this is registering in her mind because of how drunk she is, I don't know. But the fact that she's concerned that he may have gotten hit by a snowplow, and she even talks in some other clips we're going to see of this is in the vicinity of the last place she saw him, not going in the door, but over in this part of the yard, by the car, by the flagpole, kind of tells you that she saw him there. And her reactions and her tone in her reactions of this these voicemails, rationalizing, and the way that she's speaking, not just to John in these voicemails, but I think the way she's speaking to herself in these voicemails. I want to kind of go through this and piecemeal it piece by piece here, Siobhan, because there's some things to unpack, I think, as I've gone through them a bit. Let's take a listen and go through some of this. That's voicemail one. That's all it is. John, I effing hate you. If this is the Karen Reed that we've kind of come to understand as who she might be, with a lot of narcissistic traits, we can't diagnose her. So I can't say she is. You can't say she is. We don't know. But just observing the behavior. Why the rage of John, I effing hate you, right after she supposedly dropped him off at this party and she saw him go in? It doesn't seem to be an appropriate response. It to me, I'm getting John did something to her, or put her in a position that really, really struck her as, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? That's just the little piece of this. It's John, I effing hate you. Four words. What do you garner out of this? Just that piece so far.
Yeah, it's hard to know what was actually going on in the car before, you know, he got out of the car on that faithful event. And she supposedly saw him go in the house. And I guess her story is he was supposed to signal to her that it was okay to come in or come back and get her. And when that didn't happen, if any of that is even true, you know, she immediately took it as some kind of rejection, or he's in the house having sex with someone. So that would be a bizarre thing to do. Why wouldn't you, my first thought, why wouldn't you get out of the car and go yourself and say, what's up? What's going on? So the whole thing is weird, but I would have to say, let's assume that she did believe that she hit him in some way. What had been going on before? There must have been some kind of argument. And she's having this, as I talk about, the borderline reaction of, I hate you, but don't leave me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's definitely off. It doesn't fit normal behavior at all.
And that's what I'm wondering about here. The rage that she has, I believe, I mean, it has been, I believe I could be wrong, but I'm pretty confident on this, that they had been arguing in the car. At least I think she's alluded to that. And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but I believe that that's been alluded to, that there was some sort of argument. I mean, she said that they argued and she left him at the waterfall, which again, that's not true, but she's alluded to that they were arguing. So maybe that's a piece of this. Yesterday on the program, I had an interesting thought. And actually my therapist brought this up because of course I talk about Karen Reed's in therapy because it's part of my life doing
it's
this.
It's really affecting you. The trauma of this case. Yes. Well, bringing up memories.
Well, it's like, it's triggering because I'm connecting a lot of this to actual past relationships I've been in. And it's like, oh, I've been with someone like her before. But and this is just pure speculation. So take it for what it is. But if you're sitting that there and they're sitting in the car for a while, because we know that vehicle is sitting there for a while, and they're arguing and she does not go into the house. A lot of people have been speculating about, you know, the injuries to John O'Keefe's arm. Was it a dog? What was it? Was it this? Was it that? I have the injuries up on the screen here behind me, and I just want to point this out. It's the same arm injury. It's just different shots, different versions of like the color correction on it. But if you look at this closely and you kind of look at the marks, this looks more like a human claw. This looks more like someone's arm maybe holding tight with nails. Now, I don't know if she had nails. I have no, my therapist actually said, I wish they would have checked under Karen's fingernails for DNA that night.
Boy, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Not that it means she killed him, but it means if that's her claw marks, because they're very light. These are not deep wounds. It may be hard to see out there, but they're not. These are very just like you scratch with nails really hard or you're sitting there for a while and or someone's trying to pull away from you and you got the death grip going on, that could very easily happen. So I'm thinking, pure conjecture here, and this plays into where we're going with these voicemails. They're sitting in the car. She's over here. He's over here. They're kind of facing each other, talking. He's going to go out this door over here. Talking, arm over here. John wants to leave. He's had enough. He's going to go. She's holding on to him. Gets out. Gets out of the grip. Doesn't continue to give her the attention that she wants. Now, whether that's her claw marks or not, kind of besides the point, but I'm thinking something of that nature probably took place to enrage her the way that she did, where it was just a flat out, no, I'm going, I'm leaving. Gets out of the car and she's enraged, throws it in reverse. Now, not with the intent of hitting him, but mad that he's going the opposite direction of her. And, oh, God, hits him. Maybe realizes she hits him. Sees him get up. He doesn't look mortally wounded in her own words. Stumbling around the last place that she saw him, as she's said herself. And thinks, you know, he'll figure it out. He's fine. Does not want to take any sort of acceptance that, oh God, I think I just hit him. The guy everybody loves, the guy who's a saint taking in his niece and nephew. And he's so beloved by everybody. She has her image over here. This is her. This is the image that is going to be going to her because of her actions. And she is far more concerned, as we know folks like this are, with how people perceive them. Not how they necessarily perceive themselves, how people perceive them. And this doesn't equate with this, with hitting John O'Keefe. So she can't handle that. And she just ends up leaving and trying to talk herself out of not watching him die because she just thinks something else would have happened. Maybe he gets into the house. Maybe he stumbles down to Bella's mom's house and they have sex.
They were having sex.
Exactly. Yeah. And something happened because then she very quickly goes to, you're sleeping with other women. So let's go over to that next voicemail and her rage now going that way, not to I hit you, but She's trying to rationalize something else took place here.
John, I'm here with your fucking kids. Nobody knows where the fuck you are, you fucking pervert.
I'm here with your effing kids. Nobody knows where you are, you effing pervert. Nobody knows because nobody's been notified that nobody knows mm-hmm. where he is. The only person who doesn't know where he is her. Mm-hmm. So that being said, the fact that she jumps over to trying to rationalize this, trying to find some other thing that he's doing rather than deal with what she just did to him. And again, you got a 0.27 blood alcohol level. You might be going in and out of remembering what mm-hmm. you have done. Mm-hmm. What's your take thus far as we're working through that?
Well, that's where you get into what is probably the interactional pattern and the interactional style. And from the alcohol, she's not filtering. She's not pausing to consider, is this a reasonable assumption that he's out having sex with someone right now and he's a pervert? You know, this is an old story that she has been telling herself probably for ages in this relationship.
Mm-hmm. And very much projecting too, because in reality, she's the one who's sending text messages to his friend, inviting him over to have sex.
Yeah.
So naturally, John must be doing the same, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what seems to be going in her mind. Let's listen to another voicemail here as it continues on.
The defendant texts John O'Keefe.
This is a text.
Your kids
actually
are cucking alone at 1:02 a.m. on the 29th.
So you had some guilting going on.
Defendant texts John O'Keefe. I'm back in Mansfield. The kids are home alone. 1:04:14 a.m. on the 29th.
Okay, so that's manipulation mm-hmm. right there. Notice we're not getting any phone call here of, John, I'm really worried about you. I'm really concerned. I'm here with the kids. You know, I'm going to keep them safe. You know, I'm going to stay mm-hmm. here with them till I know where you are. But please let me know just so I can understand what's going on. None of that. Mm-hmm. No follow-ups. John, I still haven't heard from you. Please just let me know. No, it's I effing hate you. You're an effing pervert. Your kids are effing alone. I'm going home and I'm leaving them alone too. Because mm-hmm. of course, a responsible adult just leaves kids at home mm-hmm. alone. Mm-hmm. Again, not a healthy reaction to mm-hmm. someone who claims she saw him go into the house. Why all this rage if mm-hmm. she just thinks he went into the house to go have some drinks with friends? And why this, why this guilting in there? What's going on in her mind at this point?
Yeah, it looks like a pattern of manipulation mm-hmm. and somebody that thinks in a very self-serving manner and thinks emotionally rather than logically. Mm-hmm. So I would guess that this is something that has been used previously in arguments.
It also seems to like demonize him in her mind. And if she did something bad to him, even if it's accidental, which I do think it was accidental, mm-hmm. He has to be the bad guy because she mm-hmm. can't be the bad guy. So mm-hmm. she's starting to have to tell him herself bad things about him. He's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. He's not there for the kids. He's a bad guy. And mm-hmm. that seems to be, do you agree with that? Of just kind of, this is like, it's the beginning of this coping method that people mm-hmm. with narcissistic traits seem to have, where it's demonize the good person, the victim over here. Mm-hmm. So you can feel good about yourself.
Right. And it turns her into a victim and using the kids in that way too. Mm-hmm.
And here's the other, I think this is another one here where, let's hear it.
Yeah, it's 1 in the morning. I'm with your fucking niece and nephew. You fucking pervert. You're a fucking pervert.
So she's, I don't know if she said it in that one or if that's the next one, but she says in one of these here, I'm laying next to your niece, I believe. And she's on the phone saying that he's cheating on her and that he's a pervert. This is in mm-hmm. front of the kids that are essentially his children now. Mm-hmm. And she's verbally demonizing their uncle, who is now their dad, in front of them. Let's talk about that one for a moment.
Yeah. Yeah, that is horrendous behavior, and kids should never be exposed to that kind of stuff. So again, is there really compassion for the kids, or is that all just a show that makes her look like, see what a good person I am? But you're not acting with any awareness of the kids' needs if you say things like that in front of them.
And on a broader scope, let's talk about that. This is something that individuals like this tend to do. They will demonize the good person or anyone other than themselves as much as they possibly can. And it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't have to be friends, or it could be friends. It could be family. It could be your own kids. Let's speak to that for a moment and how this behavior seems to fall in line with this pattern of, I'm going to now demonize you passive aggressively and covertly in front of as many people as I possibly can, because she does a lot of that in this morning. Where she talks about, well, he was sleeping with this person recently, even though it had been like 2 years before her. But she's constantly belittling John and just putting his character in a very negative light. Let's just talk about how people do that and what sort of trends that points at.
Yeah, it speaks of black and white thinking, of always having this tendency to be attached to someone, deeply attached, but at the same time have pretty terrible opinions about them and saying hateful things about them. Well, why would you, if you were rational, why would you be with someone that you think that little of? Mm-hmm. So it speaks of somebody who doesn't have a very rational way of being in relationships. Painting themselves as the victim.
Yeah. What's amazing to me about this is all happening in real time while the tragedy is unfolding. It's not happening like, I think a healthy brain, and correct me if I'm wrong, a healthy brain wouldn't be doing this, but a healthy brain, if you're going to go and figure out how to villainize someone because you don't want to be responsible, you'd almost have to like get out of the situation, get out of the trauma to even begin that sort of process. Mm-hmm. With her, it's like happening as it goes. It's just second nature. It's just as things are flying at her, as realizations are coming, she's crafting the narrative of what she's telling herself. Mm-hmm. It seems. Let's continue with this.
John, I'm going home. I cannot babysit your niece. I need to go home. You are fucking using me right now. You're fucking another girl. Kim's sleeping next to me. You're a fucking loser. Fuck yourself.
Again, that's the one where she's literally laying next to the kid. Mm-hmm. Saying, and I think the tone is important here. Listen to how she says, you're effing another girl.
Fucking another girl. Kim's sleeping next to me. You are fucking using me right now. You're fucking another girl. Kim's sleeping.
And maybe I'm digging too much or reading too much in, but it's not, you're effing another girl. You're effing another girl. This is what's going on. I mean, think of that tone. This is what's happening. It's not, this is what's happening. It's this is her telling herself a story. This is not her saying to John, you're doing this. This is her telling herself that. Do you garner that out of that?
Yeah, it's the story that she has probably told herself repeatedly. And I think for people like this, they do legitimately have incredible, we'll just use the term low self-esteem, there are probably better terms for it than that, a certain amount of self-loathing, because it's hard for them to accept that somebody could really be loyal to them and really care about them. And so in that way, it says a lot about her sense of self, and that's kind of sad.
It is. I mean, at the end of the day, it's very sad.
Yeah.
That I mean, I see this, you know, when we look at these cases and you think about this and you go, gosh, it's just such horrible behavior. And there's such, but you're not them. You don't have to be them, because living in that mind, that's torture, because this is how you have to operate just to like get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
I think there's a little bit left.
Next to me, you're a fucking loser. Fuck yourself.
That might be it. I'm not sure. Then there was one last one. That was it. It sounds like John, and people are picking up on this differently. John, where are you? Or John, was that you? Is that you? Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what it says. I always thought, where are you? But mm-hmm. that one sounded really kind of nervous. That sounded like maybe mm-hmm. there's something going on here. And let's talk about the 52 calls that were made. It was just go to voicemail, redial, go to voicemail, redial. And it goes on until about, mm-hmm. I don't have the timestamp in front of me, but I believe it was like late 1-2-ish, stops and then begins again right around 5 a.m. With the call and call and call. The repeated calls over and over and over. Is that someone who is worrying, or is that someone who's looking for confirmation that what just occurred did not occur and that he's okay?
Could be both. Yeah. Could be a bit of both. It certainly, if she knew he was dead, she would not be doing that. I would never believe that somebody, I mean, they might do, oh, let me make it look like I don't know he's dead by I'll call a couple times. But that is somebody who's in a state of hysteria, and rage can be a part of that. And it says a lot about the level of emotional intensity that she operates under. This is somebody who does big feelings.
Yeah, yeah, she does big feelings, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Let's take a listen to another one here. This is the way she describes John has always been baffling to me. Like when she's looking at the video where she sees him getting in the car for the last time, it's poor guy. It doesn't speak to the level of like what happened to him. It doesn't speak to an emotional connection that seems appropriate. She refers to him as a buffalo on the prairie. Let's take a look.
John looked like a buffalo on the prairie. It was just a lawn and a heap that it wasn't a bush or a hydrant or a dog. It was a weird shaped lump at that time in those elements. And I was looking to find him on the side of the road.
There's a little bit more to it. If I could pause that for a moment. It was a weird-shaped lump in the snow. So you really couldn't see what the hell it was. But she knew exactly what it was. And she was expecting to find him there, in her own words. Let's just watch the other piece of this.
I was expecting I'd find him. And I was looking to find him on the side of the road. I was expecting I'd find him.
If you saw him go into the house, why would you be looking to find him on the side of the road?
Right. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that, well, that's why she's in the seat she's in the courtroom right now, yeah. Because it doesn't add up and it's strange.
It is. I mean, mm-hmm. is that her initial reaction to it was Jen McCabe or Carrie Roberts. I forget which call. I'm afraid he got hit by a snowplow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you saw him in the yard, which I don't know that she did, but that tells me the last she saw him was behind the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Snowplows aren't going into the yard. They're not going up by the mm-hmm. fire hydrant. They're not going mm-hmm. up by the flagpole. They're on the road. Mm-hmm. So if her initial fear is he got hit by a snowplow, the last place she saw him was either stumbling behind her car, which probably was happening because he eventually did get into the yard. Mm-hmm. Or she projected him there. I don't know the answer to that. But why else would you say that? Why would that be in your mind? Again, if you saw him go into the house, why on earth? What's going through this woman's mind that mm-hmm. that's what she's thinking? Could someone write that off to just irrational fear that you go to the worst case scenario that maybe he walked back out into the yard and then got in the road for some reason? Or is that consciousness of guilt?
It's hard to say. You know, one of the possibilities that I've entertained is that she had some sort of vague implicit memory
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't explicit, and that was because of the alcohol. And so basically, you could call it she had an intuitive sense, mm-hmm. implicitly, that maybe she hit him, and that could be something that she was pondering, mulling over, wasn't sure, and then tried to keep coming up with different scenarios. Well, it would certainly sound better to say it was a snowplow that did it rather than her car.
And I'm wondering if that's what the alibi was going to be. You know, mm-hmm. if she could pull that one off, because the alibi that she left him at the waterfall, that fell flat when she realized Jen McKay knew that they were in front of the house. So then you got to mm-hmm. find something else. And mm-hmm. then, oh, snowplow. That sounds logical and, mm-hmm. you know, fairly plausible. If he would have been in the road.
In the road. Mm-hmm.
That could easily happen. Let's watch another one. Where she's talking about the vicinity.
One more, please, Your Honor. The Commonwealth moves into evidence and seeks to play clip number 17, please.
Okay.
I gave an interview with ABC with Matt Gutman. I think this was whom I gave the interview to. And I said, he asked, why was I saying, could I hit him, did I hit him? And I said, yeah, my first thought was, I've been out late, I've been drinking, and he's in the general vicinity of where I last saw him. I mean, they talk about the left side of the property and the right as if it's, you know, Hammersmith Farms. It's a postage stamp. It's 50 feet. So he's in the front yard to the left of the front door, and no one's coming out of the house. Jen's telling me nobody's seen him. So I'm thinking, Jesus, was I starting to pull away and I ran over his foot? Like, he's roughly where I left him. So yeah, when I found him, I was thinking, did I like clip him somehow?
That's roughly where I left him. She says it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there she's very specific about it too. She's not mm-hmm. saying he was on the side of the yard where the mm-hmm. door is. He was on the other side of the yard where the flagpole
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an inconsistency that carries a lot of weight. And I would think the jury's really paying attention to that.
So how can she have both stories? I mean, that to me is just, it's baffling. You can't have both stories because mm-hmm. that does not make any sort of sense. But they're treading down this road and it's not yet been defined in court. I guess what road they're going to take in this trial, because you can't have it both ways. I just wonder if they're going to try and push through both. I mean, where do you think that will go?
Yeah, it's one of the strangest cases because of all the things that you're identifying. And as we've said before, the idea that his good friends murdered him in the house, whether it was a brawl or intentional, and then laid his body out in the front yard. It just doesn't add up.
Here's one more of Karen talking about her realization that she's having. I think it's kind of powerful for trying to understand.
There was a woman who was a mother to kids that were close to John's kids who lived very close to the Alberts. In fact, when Jen was navigating John to the Alberts when I was driving, she said, it's near Ashley's house. Ashley and John hooked up prior to John and I dating.
You think that triggered her?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it was a marker
sure.
that
mm-hmm.
Jen said, it's near Ashley's house.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? I mean,
sure sounds like it.
That in itself could be the trigger right there that could go to the, are you cheating on me? Are you doing mm-hmm. this? Just the word of an ex.
Yep. Just the name.
Just mm-hmm. the name. Let's keep listening.
Two things. Either he's hurt himself and is incapacitated. He could be passed out on someone's couch, which is just weird. We're not on a campus. Everyone lives in their own home with children.
That's another weird observation of hers. And it seems just so parallel to reality. These people are all drinking together. They're out super late. It's not a crazy idea that someone's going to pass out on someone's couch.
Not at all crazy. We've seen that happen.
Like,
yeah.
For her to say that that is a crazy idea. No, that's like the most logical of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But she's... it's so weird how they perceive things, because what's coming out of their prism is like opposite of what reality is. Let's keep going.
Or he's sleeping with someone. And there were multiple women in the neighborhood of Fairview that John had been with. And one of them, very recently, before I started dating John.
Very recently before I started. So that's 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm with Jen McCabe and Carrie Roberts. And Carrie Roberts is Ford Explorer. And I'm in the back, leaning over the front two seats. Carrie's driving and Jen's in the passenger seat. And I describe this to everyone, so you've probably heard this before, but John looked like a buffalo on the prairie. It was just a lawn and a heap that it wasn't a bush or a hydrant or a dog. It was a weird-shaped lump at that time in those elements. And I was looking to find him on the side of the road. I was expecting I'd find him. And the fear of what I was going to see is the worst feeling I've ever experienced. The anticipation of what is awaiting me was as extreme a feeling. I wouldn't say it was as extreme a feeling as the grief of realizing what happened to him.
Fear and grief she's talking about in those moments, and realizing what happened to him in those moments. What is she talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it fear for herself? And why, you know, if you have been entertaining all night the idea that he's with another woman, that's what also jumps out to me. Why would you be driving along expecting to see him in the snow?
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a lot of what we are seeing. Of course, the conspiracy to play out involves now more than 40 people, many different departments of government, and then civilians, housewives, teachers, just every normal human being from white collar to blue collar. It's just a section of society, everyone. Mm-hmm. And most don't know each other. And they all would have had to conspire at the same time to go against Karen Reed and somehow, I don't know, plant evidence. I mean, because we've now heard about, well, the solo cups, that's a big thing. Like, yeah, what does it even prove? It's John's blood at the end of the day.
Right.
This is Kate McLaughlin. This is a first responder on the scene that they were trying to discredit about her relationship with one of the Elbert's daughters. But this is her testimony, which was pretty solid. It's another recognition of her saying, I hit him.
Once we had come to a stop, I asked if there had been any significant trauma that happened that preceded this. And she answered with a series of statements that she repeated. I hit him. I hit him. There was a woman next to us who told her to calm down. Stop talking, calm down, you're hysterical. So she repeated, I hit him. And a police officer asked her, said, you what? And she repeated it again, I hit him. And the officer then signaled for his sergeant to come down to the scene or down to where he was.
When she first told you that she had hit him, you said there was another woman next to her. Did you know who that woman was?
Not at the time.
Do you now know who that woman was?
I do.
And who was that?
Miss Jen McCabe.
Did you know Miss McCabe at that time?
No.
Do you know her personally now?
No.
Are you friendly or friends with her in any way?
No.
You mentioned that when the defendant said, I hit him. Miss McCabe was trying to intervene?
Yes, it appeared that way.
What did it appear she was trying to do?
Trying to get her to calm down, to stop talking. It appeared that she was
sustained.
She was
was disregard that comment.
Did Ms. McCabe interject verbally?
Yes.
After Ms. McCabe interjected and the defendant made those statements about hitting him, did you persist in getting more information, asking to clarify what she meant by I hit him?
No, I did not.
Why not?
A few reasons. I felt at that point, given the situation and how disturbing, and it was a very emotional situation, the woman was very upset.
Does she seem like someone who's conspiring to cover this up and just make up and pin it on Karen Reed by saying she heard him say I hit him and risk her career, risk her credibility, no. Risk everything?
No, absolutely not. She seems very credible. I would believe her.
Yeah. Here, I found it interesting, and I don't think it's playing well to the jury, Alan Jackson's line of questioning. He seems to be getting them to repeat their original testimony from direct over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And to get the people to keep saying, I heard her say I hit him. I don't know that you want to keep pounding that into the jury's head if you're the defense of Karen Reed. Here's another clip from the other day.
I hit him. It's my fault. I did it. That's a confession, correct?
She said, I hit him. I hit him. I hit him. I hit him.
And Officer Seraf just stands there and my client walks away, correct?
You'd have to talk to Officer Seraf about that.
Oh, we have.
You should.
Ms. McLaughlin.
Objection. Okay,
so.
And according to you, you're writing on your glove.
Yes.
What kind of glove?
Just a regular latex glove that we use on the ambulance.
You didn't have a notepad?
I probably did. Sometimes it's easier to just write it down on your glove.
Right. Did you write, I hit him on your
glove? No, I did not.
So he's questioning, well, why didn't the officer intervene? If she's saying, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him. Keep in mind, they eventually took her to a psych hold.
So, exactly.
So, I mean, would an officer intervene at that moment in time when she's saying, did I hit him? I hit him, in every combination of that. I know you're not in law enforcement, but I mean, does it make any sense at that moment in time to intervene? It's not like she's going anywhere. It's a chaotic. It's a life or death scene at this moment in time.
Yeah. 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 It's hard to say what was in the officer's mind, what the officer heard, but I think that this witness was very credible. And I think you can probably from, you know, Detective Proctor to various things that were done, one can pick apart the way that the investigation went.
Sure.
Why didn't they search the house? You know, those are valid points, but that doesn't negate the I hit him, and the rest of the behavior that we've seen.
Correct. And I agree. There's plenty of pieces of this investigation that could have been done better. But the more I look at it, though, too, the more I'm just, it's a small department.
Yeah.
It's a nor'easter. I thought it was powerful. They had a meteorologist come in and say it was like one of the worst ones on record at that moment in time. And you are having inches of snow come down every single hour onto a crime scene that is based in snow.
Yeah.
And the criticism is you're gathering this in solo cups. That's all they had at the moment. They did.
Exactly.
They eventually did bring evidence bags in, but when snow is coming down that fast, and if you've never been in an environment like this, you just don't know, because it will change like that. You fresh snow, give it 10 minutes, it's going to look like nobody was at this crime scene if everybody walked away at that moment. So I do kind of get where the officers are coming from on, look, if we didn't get this now, we're not going to get it. What's the best thing we can do to get the evidence without actually touching it? I mean, if they were really, really incompetent, they would have just started with their gloves just digging, which wouldn't have been a good idea. But they tried what they could. Was the leaf blower the best idea? I don't know. But it certainly allowed them to find blood. It allowed them to find evidence that was buried under the snow.
Right.
Kind of hard to plant evidence under snow.
Under the snow. Very, very true. Yeah, it does make sense under the conditions.
And the tinier pieces of the taillight are making a lot more sense to me as well. Because, again, tiny, tiny pieces, snow, everyone is walking over this scene. When you walk over a scene like that, and it keeps being cold and it keeps snowing, you know what happens to that bottom layer? It turns to ice.
Ice. Mm-hmm.
And even when you do brush the snow away, then you got that ice layer. You're not mm-hmm. going to get to the grass. Try getting to grass in this sort of a situation where it's been trampled down and more snow came on top of it. You're not
going to do it. Impossible.
Unless you're there with a mm-hmm. flamethrower, you're not going to get to the grass. So why did they find these smaller pieces later? It's not because they were planted. It's because it had to melt.
Yeah, 100%.
You weren't going to find it.
100%.
Had it not been snowing, had it been a bright, sunny day or just cold and the ground is open, it's a totally different argument. But you mm-hmm. have to take the weather into account because that plays such a huge role in this whole thing. Why is it so difficult for people to wrap their minds around just basic facts of this case?
Yeah, I think it's crazy the way that this has gone, the public, sentiment with the again, we can use the word hysteria support of her. There's just not a lot of logic. There's a lot of emotional thinking and the team sport aspect to it. And it's just one of those unfortunate things because we would all like to know what really happened.
Yeah.
And we may never really get that. We can get our best guesses at this point based upon the evidence.
Jackson was also trying to discredit Kate McLaughlin here as being biased or something because she was acquaintances with the Elbert's daughter. Not besties. They're not hanging mm-hmm. out together. But I don't know this just seems like a very easy one for most people to understand. If you have a circle of friends, they have friends too. When everybody gets together at a gathering, there's usually a lot of people you don't know, or you kind of know who they are. You've seen them around, but you're not, you're kind, you're friendly. You may end up in a picture next to each other because, okay, everybody get together.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that somehow, because the daughter of the Elberts, which is the house where this happened, and this first responder are in a general circle together, they went to school together, that somehow she's going to, again, put her career, everything on the line for this acquaintance. And Jackson trying to tie the dots or like there's something else.
The reality is
scary.
Ms. McLaughlin, your relationship with Caitlin Albert is far more than simply somebody that you went to high school with. Isn't that true?
I described what it is.
Do you stand by your testimony that Caitlin Albert is, quote, somebody I went to high school with somebody by that name?
I said that, and I described the relationship numerous times throughout that testimony to clarify it.
And you clarified it under questioning by me, correct?
Yes. And Mr. Lally, he asked follow-ups.
And in fact, you were shown some of these photographs last year, too.
Objection.
Sustained.
The reason you clarified it is because you were confronted with photos of yourself last year, correct?
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. The reason you clarified it, as you just testified, your relationship, is because you were confronted with photographs of you and Caitlin Albert last year, correct?
I just answered the questions that you had.
Right. And you were shown photographs last year.
I was, yes.
There's also another member of the Albert family that you've spoken to about this case, isn't that right?
No.
January 30th, 2022, you were contacted by a member of the Canton Police Department to set up an interview for you.
No, I was not.
You remember being contacted by anybody to set up an interview with Michael Proctor?
The state police called me, and I met with two state troopers.
So she didn't know who they were. I don't know. I'm baffled by this. He's not getting the questions that he wants. And it's just, it's attorney speak. So I'm not really that baffled, but isn't it true? Isn't it true? Even if you're completely wrong and you're being shut down every stretch of the mind, the way you're just going to keep saying, isn't this true? Isn't this true? Isn't this true? How do you think this is playing to a jury? Because it's really feeling badgering to innocent people who were part of a traumatic situation, even first responders. I mean, they are human beings, too. There is trauma involved, especially when someone like her starts getting harassed by these lunatics out there. And she's just doing her job, showing up to a situation, trying to save someone's life. And somehow now she's part of this grand conspiracy.
Yeah. His approach, I know I've heard some attorneys that think he's doing a great job and they like his approach. I find it too aggressive bullying. Mm-hmm. And when you combine that with what the community, the Karen supporters have done to these people, it pushes me in the other direction. I don't care for it. I would have a very negative emotional response to his behavior if I were in the jury.
How does an otherwise, I don't know, I wouldn't say rational, but I don't think you are rational if you're going to think that this is, that she is someone who is conspiring on this. But how do people, and I'm not talking about the cult leader of all this, I'm talking about just the average people who find themselves being cult members, somehow twist that into this grand conspiracy and somehow it registers in their mind that, yes, this person is conspiring and they're lying and they're making all this up, despite just reality on reality's terms proving everything the exact opposite way. How what are the mental gymnastics going on here in these people's minds?
The human capacity for team sports and for the us versus them mentality, why people in groups can do horrible things that if they weren't in a group, they would never have acted that way. Mm-hmm. But you put all of them together, you put them in the same place online where this emotional reasoning just builds up and they lose all ability to think rationally. And some people are very prone to that kind of emotional reasoning. Unfortunately, it's not the best of our human traits, but people do bad things that way.
The icing on the cake to all of this is the reality that Karen was very drunk through all of this, and that was confirmed through Hannah Knoll's testimony.
And based on your calculations, as far as the 93 milligrams per deciliter, what does that convert to as far as the blood alcohol concentration for the defendant at 9:08 a.m. on January 29th?
93 milligrams per deciliter in serum alcohol concentration would convert to between 0.078 and 0.082 grams per cent.
And from your calculations and your retrograde analysis, what was the range that you were able to calculate for the defendant's blood alcohol concentration at 12:45 a.m. on January 29th?
Between 0.14 and 0.28 grams per cent.
Almost to a 3.0.
Incredible.
Just
absolutely
almost
incredible.
Now, tell me, what's going on with the human brain at that level?
Complete loss of the prefrontal cortex, which is the logical thinking part of the brain, controlled by the amygdala, which is the emotional part of the brain. It speaks about her, I will say, alcohol dependence, because she was still driving a car. Mm-hmm. She could still make phone calls. And I think if I were that intoxicated, not only would I have been puking for hours, but I would certainly not be able to drive a car and make phone calls. I mean, a lot of people would be passed out at that point. So when I talk about this, is somebody that I think really has a drinking problem. People who are alcoholic, they have the ability to appear fairly normal. They may not even be slurring. They may be doing functional things, but their thinking brain is not present. It is not plugged in. And so you get this much more primitive, emotional, almost animalistic behavior coming out where they will do things that if they were sober, they wouldn't do. And so I think that's a huge factor in this.
When we're talking about that, because everybody goes, well, she has a high tolerance. Okay, I certainly buy that, the fact that she's able to do that. But high tolerance, that doesn't mean that your body isn't and your brain isn't reacting 100%, the same ways that 100%. Everybody else is.
Yeah. Yeah, the hippocampus, the memory part of the brain that controls memory, is not functioning normally at all.
Yeah.
And that's where most people would be in a complete blackout, where they're, and that doesn't mean passed out. It simply means they're going around appearing functional, often not even appearing intoxicated if you don't look too closely, but their brain is not functioning properly at all.
How do people get to that state where, like, others, you know, and early on, if you're drinking, you'd be able to, you just pass out, you'd be done.
You pass out, you throw up, and you pass out.
How is it that the brain somehow learns to function at that level of intoxication, where otherwise it would have taken you up, but somehow you can somehow appear relatively with it, relatively sober to a certain extent, and still keep moving around? I mean, that nothing to do with the case, but just like, what the hell? How does the brain do that?
Yeah, it is really, really interesting, the impact of alcohol on the brain. And for somebody that drinks a lot over a long period of time, this is something that just adapts, that certain parts of the body can tolerate it, but certainly the prefrontal cortex doesn't tolerate it. And so it's just one of those weird things about alcoholism. And I think a lot of people think, well, if she wasn't slurring, she wasn't, you know, stumbling, that means she was okay. And that's not true. It doesn't work that way.
No. And that's quite a high level. I mean, possibly near a 0.3.
Unbelievable.
That's like stomach pumping. And like, she kept going. Yeah. She could have died of alcohol poisoning herself. I mean, even if she thinks she's good, your organs and your brain don't.
Exactly. And that's one of the concerns. When in one of the interviews I heard with her, the TV interview, she was saying, oh, well, I had a little bit of a buzz, but I, you know, didn't really feel it. I wasn't impaired. Okay, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. And if she's still talking nonsense about that, what else is nonsense?
That's the biggest question here. I think we are all asking. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, thank you for joining us. You have that memoir coming out too. When does it come out and where can people get it?
It is out.
And it's
it
out,
can be
yes.
ordered. It is out. It can be ordered from any bookseller. Amazon's got it. It's Nightbird, one word, by Siobhan Scott, Nightbird. And any bookstore can get it if you don't want to use Amazon. And yeah, it's done really well. And I'm thrilled at the reviews. I'm honored.
I need a copy.
Okay. Well, make sure you get one.
I need one.
And it's also on Audible with read by the author. It just came out on Audible.
I'm doing that. I mean, because I do Audible all the time. So
okay.
I'm going to be doing Audible. I'm going to go buy it today on Audible. So yeah. All right. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure and always extremely interesting as we break this thing down.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. BetterHelp recently surveyed over 16,000 people and found that while 75% of people believe it's wise to seek support, only 27% of Americans are in therapy, and people stay silent to avoid being judged. BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching you with the right therapist, because we're all better with help. Visit BetterHelp.com/stopthestigma for their first ever State of Stigma report, the latest in mental health research. This is an ad by BetterHelp. BetterHelp recently surveyed over 16,000 people and found that while 75% of people believe it's wise to seek support, only 27% of Americans are in therapy, and people stay silent to avoid being judged. BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching you with the right therapist, because we're all better with help. Visit BetterHelp.com/stopthestigma for their first ever State of Stigma report, the latest in mental health research. This is an ad by BetterHelp. BetterHelp recently surveyed over 16,000 people and found that while 75% of people believe it's wise to seek support, only 27% of Americans are in therapy, and people stay silent to avoid being judged. BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching you with the right therapist, because we're all better with help. Visit betterhelp.com/stopthestigma for their first ever State of Stigma report, the latest in mental health research.